Well, hello, superstars, and welcome back to another episode of Word Up with Danny Katz. Today I am joined by John Coleman, educator and founder of the Apocatastasis Institute. I'm so proud of myself for saying that right. John Coleman has founded this remarkable alternative learning institute for students 15 going all the way up to adults in their 50s and 60s. And as he does mention on today's show, he has made some exceptions for younger students. What I love so much about what John is doing and why I had him on the show today is because he's offering an alternative to the established Rockefeller education system, mind control psyop, whatever that is. But he's also offering an alternative to the homeschooling, unschooling paradigm, wherein there isn't a lot of academic rigor, there isn't a lot of discipline around learning the classics, understanding where we came from in terms of American culture. So I love that John is offering an alternative to the established Rockefeller schooling system, but he's not throwing the baby out with the bathwater. He's not throwing away intellectual rigor, diving deep into subjects in ways that are, you know, as of now, aren't really being promoted or fostered in the homeschooling, unschooling environment. So today we dive deep into the realm of alternative education from a more classical, intellectually rigorous perspective. Before we dive in, I'm reminding you to click that subscribe button, to like, to share, to comment, to tell all your friends to tune into the Word Up podcast. I'm reminding you to sign up for my newsletter at dannykatz.com. And also reminding you, as I'm going to touch in on again at the end of the first half of today's show, that I do offer a pop propaganda media literacy course for teens as well as grown-ups alike, which is actually part of how I connected with John Coleman in the first place. Given that we're on the topic of alternative education for teens, I feel I would be remiss if I didn't remind you that I am offering the one and only antidote to propaganda, media manipulation, and groupthink by way of my own 11-module pop propaganda course, which is available on my website, dannykatz.com. Okay, that does it for our pre-show housekeeping. Buckle up and prepare to enjoy my conversation with John Coleman. John Coleman, hi. Welcome to the show. How are you?
Hey, I'm well, Danny. Thank you so much for having me. I'm looking forward to our talk here. And it's a nice autumn afternoon here in Connecticut. It's still pretty warm out, good running weather. It's not not too hot, not too cold. It's just right.
Nice. Yeah, we're being blessed with the same weather here in New Mexico. Normally it's like bundle up time, but it's still pretty nice here as well.
Nice. Do you have the leaves and all this sort of jazz out there that we have? Probably not as much as dramatically, but.
Not as dramatically. Right now, everything's yellow. It's the season where all the aspens on the ski mountain turn yellow. So it's like this just giant bright yellow blotch. And then all the kind of bushes on the side are yellow. I call it the season of yellow.
Nice. I can get used to that.
Yeah. Let's talk about education.
Let's indeed. Yes, ma'am.
Because I know you're doing wonderful things and I always mess up the name. Is it, I'm going to ask you to say it because I mangle it every time.
Sure. The word of my school is Apokestastasis. It's a Greek word and it means restoration. So Apokestastasis Institute.
Apokestastasis.
Yeah,
it's the Stasis where I tend to get tripped up.
it's a tongue twister. If I was a marketing person, I might have chosen a different name altogether. But I like it. It keeps people on their toes, makes them work for it.
Yeah. So I'm curious to know the history of the Institute, how you got into education in the first place, the whole backstory.
Okay, sure. Well, I guess we should start way back when. During my undergrad years in Danbury, I was asked to teach at a little school. A lot of homeschoolers and things were pulling their hair out, and so they had come together to create this school at a nearby church, and I was asked to come and teach geography, and that took about the next 10 years of my life, 11 years altogether, trying to work on this project. And what I found out is that a lot of people who have good ideas and they have enough gasoline to work on those ideas and to act on those ideas to a certain extent oftentimes don't have enough vision and enough gasoline, so to speak, enough talents, enough stamina to bring things to fulfillment. And so this particular community, the talk was, you know, we're building a full-fledged high school and, you know, all hands on deck. And it became clear after 11 years of this thing collapsing and rebuilding and people fooling around and I think wasting talents and resources, it became clear to me that this was not going to come to pass. And so in 2013, I decided at this impasse, right, I can't stay at this school anymore. It's intolerable. Then I'm thinking, well, if I go into public school or private school or tutoring or college, it's going to be even more henpecky. It's going to be more suffocating. At least this place, for whatever its faults, at least gave me a little bit of elbow room. I'm going to have no elbow room in this situation in schools now, public, private, or tutoring or whatever. So it was one of those things, like either I had to make my own school or to seek a vocation elsewhere. And so that's the genesis of Apakistostasis. We started in 2013, and I didn't know my ass from my elbow then, and I don't think I do now, but I've learned a lot of skills over the years, communication skills and all sorts of things. I never, time zones, speaking about interviews and things like that, financial stuff and all that. My training, like most of our training, was simply to be someone else's worker. And so I've had to pick up over the last 10 years, we're celebrating our 10th anniversary this year, had to pick up a lot of skills. And I think little by little, those are bearing fruit. So that's, you know, kind of where I'm coming from in a nutshell.
And what were the freedoms that you were pinpointing as lacking in the established schools or established system?
Oh, it's that's a great question. There's academic freedoms in the case of the public schools in Connecticut, and actually nationally too, since Common Core and all this. There's the testing regime, so that's going to play on things. There's the nature of administration is such that it doesn't want to step on anybody's toes. Schools see themselves as businesses. They speak of themselves as businesses, mm-hmm. and they have the psychology of businesses, which means you're trying to appeal to the broadest number of people. I find this a tremendous distortion of what schools should be acting like, but that's the situation. And so not only do you have the suffocation of the testing regime, but you also have the spirit of not rocking the boat, not stepping on toes. And what the hell is academics? What is academics for? But to ask difficult questions, but to step on toes professionally and you know, with decorum and things, and there are some restraints there. But there is, I think, too much of the businessman mindset in schools. And so in my own life, and I know this is far worse in the normie schools, let's say, that there is no backing of teachers. You are the whipping boy for society, who blames you for being the brainwasher. Hey, teacher, leave those kids alone. And I'm not saying that some of these critiques aren't valid, by the way. You have that, and then you have an administration which will throw you under the bus, lickety split. And so the teacher is this hopeless character, and they know it, and that's why the average turnover for a teacher is 4 or 5 years between getting into the field and getting the hell out. And so those would be the two responses to that question about that suffocation is the the nature of the bureaucracy with the testing is such that it doesn't allow teachers elbow room, and the administration is so afraid of pissing off parents and the school board and things. They don't trust the teacher, frankly, and that's fundamentally what I've been bumping up against altogether now, coming up on 20 years, is the tremendous lack of trust in society amongst teachers with so many aspects, and we can maybe look at that proper down the line.
Yeah. And so I'm curious, in terms of like the academic freedoms, were there certain things that maybe the system won't allow teachers to teach? Is all of the testing all of the academia geared towards students passing these tests? Like, break down the whole sham of this kind of testing culture.
Sure. I mean, and this is getting to the deeper error of how we envision schools. So in the mainstream schools, whether that's your public or your private, and I would say homeschool largely is aping this exact system. It's not nearly as countercultural as it might imagine itself to be all the time. And it's largely the same fundamental system. We even use this almost mechanical, very modern 20th century language of a system, like a machine system. Mm-hmm. And so the teacher and the curricula and the students that are supposed to be spit out from these schools are largely interchangeable. Just like in my car, I can switch out the brake booster or the starter or something with another one, and one's just as good as another. And it's this psychology of the machine which explains the testing, and this idea that you can. In fact, that's why it's not a crisis. You should have hair on fire as an American population that we don't keep teachers, and that there's such heavy turnover. You have hair on fire that there's such loss of institutional memory, and that it doesn't matter really, because the system. One teacher is just as interchangeable as another, just like a starter on a car. And everything's supposed to be streamlined to produce, finally, the product. What is the product of the modern school? It's a public individual. And it's only the past 5 years, Danny, that I've really understood the profundity of that, mm-hmm. The honesty of the public schools. I used to get so angry at the public schools and look at their agendas, and they're dumbing us down, and they're extinguishing the spark in the child's eye, until I hit my legal dictionaries and I read what the word public is, and it means commercial. Mm-hmm. And then when you realize that, then this system, and it is a system aped. Let us not be a cock of the heap here. Some of us, we can, in alternative education, I'm speaking to myself, first of all, let's not get too cocky here. A lot of what we're doing is just aping this. So we need to watch out for that. They say when you point one finger, you have three more pointing back. So I want to be conscious of that too. But the public school is meant to make public people. The commercial school is meant to make commercial people. Of course you have to extinguish the wonder in a child's eye. Of course you have to smother inquisitiveness. I'm not advocating for this. I'm saying within this system, if you're trying to make a commercially successful person in this dead society of fictions, you have to do this. And so that explains the mindless testing, the mindless changing out, and not just changing out of staff in terms of hiring and firing, but also the changing out of subjects every 45 minutes, the changing out of the individual interacting with the child, so that there are these deep bonds that are not being formed. And it's not just that they're not being formed, they're not being made. They're being broken deliberately to produce an interchangeable public worker as an adult.
Wow. It's all hitting home because I'm studying law right now. So I'm learning about the difference between the public and the private and commercial. And of course, it makes total sense. And breaking these bonds, which is one of my biggest frustrations in society, how quickly things change and we're told we have no choice and we're moving towards automation and this is just how it goes. And so it makes sense when you're indoctrinating the youth this way, why they would just be, it's easy for them to go along with it because they don't no otherwise, which is something that terrifies me as far as handing over, you know, the responsibility for our planet to people who've been indoctrinated through these systems.
Yeah, it's quite remarkable. And that's, I like the way you phrase that, just the how quickly things are. I can't quite snap as good as you, but you can't pronounce epicystasis and I can't snap, so we're even.
Totally.
But the changing of everything. I mean, half the country, we enjoy the fall here and you enjoy your yellow aspens, but half the country has been wiped out. And I'll bite my tongue unless you want me to not bite my tongue as to what happened in the South the past couple of weeks with these hurricanes.
You can speak freely. We're not on YouTube, so you can speak totally freely about the ridiculousness with that situation. Yeah.
So for maybe people watching this out of the country or people whose attention has been broken for 12 years in a school in this very thing, right? Half, you know, a good lot of the South, we'll say, has been severely damaged. And it's been at the, you know, the kindest one can say is a tremendous failure on the part of the civil authorities to address it, who may have caused it to begin with, but that's a whole topic right there. And yet we're on to the next thing. We're on to Israel anniversary today, and we'll be on to some stupid election stuff tomorrow, and we'll be on to some celebrity. And it's just to your point, how do we develop this where it's so quick and nobody's paying attention to anything? A lot of that has to do with how we were trained to integrate material, which is we weren't trained. We were not trained. Our concentration was broken up, and there was no attempt whatsoever to integrate mathematics and natural science and history and literature, and certainly no attempt to integrate the same adults interacting with the children for several years. And I have had that privilege and that ability just because of the nature of my work. There's not so many hands on deck, and so I wear a lot of hats. And so I've been with some of these children for 5 and 6 years, and you see having the ability to develop an intellectual relationship for that length, the difference between students who don't have that benefit, and that carries over into adulthood individually, and that carries over into this society where people are just led around like hogs by the nose with the latest crises and forget about this and brush this under the mat, and nobody notices because it goes back partially to how we were trained to think or not trained.
Yeah, exactly, or to not think, to simply follow. So you mentioned, so you started the Institute in 2013, but you had spent 10 years previously. So when you started teaching, had Common Core curriculum been implemented?
That was just rolling out. So let's see, we have to go back in our little time machine here. This would have been myself coming online. This would have been the autumn of 2007. And so the very end of the Bush years, you had the Great Recession, as it's still called, and coming into Obama's time. So Common Core would have been really coming into its stride probably by 2009. So yeah, I'd have been coming in just at about that time. Now, this was a private school, so we didn't really have to worry so much about that. And at that point, that school was very aware, just because of the community that it tended to coalesce around. Those people tend to be really hands-off with the government. They knew well enough that if you take anything from those people, any grants or whatever, the Piper is going to get, you're going to send his bill. And there's a two-way street when you accept federal money there. So I didn't have to worry so much about that aspect of things. But to your question, yes, that was coming on. We had just come off the fad of No Child Left Behind in the height of the Bush years, yep, which is really where the testing came into its own. This talk of schools failing, it goes back to the 80s. It happens about every 20 years. There's like this big crisis report that'll be published, or there'll be a new fad about every 20 years. So Reagan, and then the Bush years, and then Obama came along with the Obama Core, or the Common Core. And it's the same line of thought, it's the same thing, but it just kind of refines itself and becomes more obnoxious each time. I spoke to people who actually were hired as contractors for Common Core, and they were obviously on board for it, but even they complained that this thing was, you know, just slapped together. The governors were trying to get it out as fast as possible, so they were just putting anything together. just one little vignette. I remember a gentleman I knew who at that time was still alive in newspaper work, and he had done a whole series on Common Core. And he had pointed out that there was a unit they do in high school in New York State at that time on Frankenstein, Shelley's Frankenstein. And he pointed out, you know, they read a modernized version of Frankenstein. They watch Young Frankenstein with Mel Brooks. They play a Frankenstein game in class. But at the end of it, he pointed out, at no point is Frankenstein actually being read. No one's actually reading the actual text material. And so it was little silly things like that kind of got passed through because of how much it was rushed to get this latest fad up on its feet.
Right. I'm in the process of finishing. I'm unfortunately these days I'm a very slow reader. But I've been reading Jim Marr's Fourth Reich, The Rise of the Fourth Reich. And I just finished the section on education and talking about how it, you know, very deliberately targeted by the Rockefeller. I don't know if that's so much a family at this point as like a whole syndicate or, you know, a code word for something darker and more nefarious. Exactly as you said, just to create workers, just to create slaves for the system. We don't want too much critical thinking. We don't want too much independence cultivated. Yeah. I'm intrigued by what you're doing because, you know, I've been teaching homeschool for the past few years, and I've been in these communities and conversations with parents who are really down on the established school systems. But what you address, which I feel like is not being addressed, is academic rigor and people who authentically want to dive really, really deep into certain subjects and really tussle with the intellect. And that seems to be completely thrown aside by the modern day homeschool movement.
Yeah, and my comments here are coming from a place of support. I just want to say that where I'm going with this, as I know yours are too. So sometimes people get, maybe they get a little bit tense, but when we're bringing this up, we're not coming from a hostile angle here. But yes, I believe that the homeschool community is very much living off a reputation that it developed in the 80s and the 90s. In terms of academic rigor and a certain professionalism that it had at that point. It was a very plucky movement coming out of the 70s, and it was, you know, it had to justify itself. And in those days, the 80s and the 90s, it very much did earn a lot of the cred. And what I think has happened as the movement has grown quite a bit, especially since the days of COVID, the great grounding, maybe historians will call those strange 3 years.
Yeah.
Homeschool grew a great bit. And these realities became, like in every institution and in every community, they became these catchwords that less and less had substance to them. And I've come across, I'm not speaking about one or two or five or 10 people here, but, you know, like you, bumping into all sorts of people in that world, and you can drive trucks through the knowledge of some of those children in very basic aspects of, you know, in my sense, in history and literature and things that I would have known in public school that they don't know. And I'm largely why I'm putting so much energy into Epicastasis Institute is because I'm planning for what's going to replace the colleges and the schools as we see them now. And when it comes to grade school, I very much believe that the mainstream schools are being left go to seed. Mm-hmm. And we can talk about some specifics there. But when it comes to homeschool, I believe they're also being given right now, parents, please pay attention. You're being given enough rope to hang yourselves. You're being let get sloppier and sloppier. Your children, no judgment here. Almost every one of your children has a birth certificate here. The state has jurisdiction over them. You can piss and moan, and you can pound sand as far as the state's concerned. You sign that contract, You gave them 51% jurisdiction, let's say. You are merely their legal parent. I don't support that. I know you, you know, you don't support that, Danny, but that's the system. We have to live through life. No judgment there. But why I'm saying that is when the state wants to pull the noose that we have put around our neck, they will roll up homeschooling so fast, your head's going to spin. And that's why we need to right now start providing against that justification. There is now, you can go on these forums like Reddit and things, adults who have gone through homeschooling, unschooling, who are pissed off, and they're pissed off enough now that they're trying to get legislation passed to regulate homeschooling and unschooling. These are people who came out of those systems. Mm-hmm. And so before it's too late, we still in this country have a lot of elbow room compared to places like Europe. I spoke to a gentleman called Lorenzo, and it's impossible where he lives in Japan to do anything like homeschooling. Extremely regulated in Europe. We need to, whilst we have the sunshine, just shape up. We have to hit the gym, so to speak, intellectually speaking. It's not too far gone. But, you know, as they say, with great power comes great responsibility. We have a great freedom in America for this homeschooling. Let's just tighten up ourselves. Let's tighten up what we're teaching. Let's put a bit more rigor there. And those would be my counsels in that neck of the woods. Because I think ultimately in this whole Hegelian thing, they're going to shut down the mainstream schools and they're going to shut down homeschooling. And you're just going to have, you know, a Bill Gates robot telling you like Siri, this stuff. And you're going to just spit it out of the test, and then you'll be job certified and you'll be on Massa's plantation for the rest of your days.
Okay, I have so many competing thoughts because I'm very curious about your vision as to where this is going. But before we go there, where do you think the homeschooling, unschooling, and again, I'm with you, no disrespect. You know, I completely honor the parents who understand that the indoctrination camps called schools are not appropriate. And it's like we're on the new frontier, right? And everyone's doing the best they can. And I have so much compassion for my friends who did breed and didn't realize that they would be responsible for their children's education. That's a lot to put on a family, especially given the economy where most people, you know, both parents are working, all of that. So I'm with you, no disrespect, but from your perspective, where do you see homeschooling, unschooling, getting it wrong, or doing the students a disservice?
I think I will not bite my tongue. I've been asked not to bite my tongue, so I shall not. I think there could be more male leadership in it. I think there's a lack of discipline, which comes from fathers not being present in this. They've largely shifted off the blame, or not the blame, but the labor to their wives. And that, I think, leads to what's the problem? Changing all the time, changing curricula, changing tutors, having no idea what to do semester to semester, year to year. If there were more men involved, if the fathers took more of a role, I think that problem would naturally sort itself out with a bit more long-term vision there. That would be, I would say, the most immediate thing is to know with your child's education, what are they doing this year? What will they be doing next year, 5 years, 10 years out? And to have that vision on that lighthouse, whatever that is, and then to make that happen, as opposed to, as I say, monkey branching it, you know, from one fad, we're going to public school this year, now we're going to homeschool, now we're going to nature school. Oh, we're going to do Waldorf, Danny. We're going to do Waldorf for a year. Nah, I didn't like Waldorf. Next semester, we're going into unschooling and so forth. There's a lot of this. Maybe that's a dramatic example, but there is a lot of that. And that is creating and maybe exacerbating that lack of stability that already exists in modern Rockefeller education, as I call it myself. It may actually be worse in that regard of stability. On the one hand, however shoddy homeschooling might be, the child at least has the stability of the home, which has a tremendous emotional benefits to it, and that cannot be overlooked. And I think that factor explains some of the discipline problems and the psychological problems that attend public school children so endemically, is that emotional stability in the home. So bravo for the homeschoolers there and the unschoolers. But that beyond that, the stability is very shoddy in terms of intellectually planning where the student will be and making sure that happens. There's a bit too much informality. If one is learning, I would give the unschoolers a much more broader berth on that, because they're not pretending to formally instruct.
Right.
The homeschoolers are alleging that they're providing this disciplined instruction oftentimes when they're too informal to really be taken seriously on that point.
I love this point that you're making, and I hadn't thought about it like that, but it does seem like I understand the pushback against the expert class and you know, the lore around academia, and I'm certainly one of those leading that charge, but I also feel like we shouldn't, it's not wise to throw the baby out with the bathwater. You know, there is something to having an expert in a subject teach our children versus we're winging it because we're so free-willing. And I have noticed this, it's interesting kind of conflation, because I see a lot of parents taking their kids out of school. And I just want to be, are you offended when I say kids? I know some people get upset with the kind of satanic reference.
Oh, no, not at all, Danny. But I do appreciate your compassion there. I know you asked some, you know, in this point or just before we started, you're very sensitive with that. And I appreciate that.
Thank you. And I know so many parents who are removing their children, kids, teens, whatever you want to call them, from school because they're afraid of the woke agenda. But I also know the woke agenda is modeled on Maoism, where the children are the ultimate authority who boss the parents around. And I see this happening in homeschool and unschool, where the parents are kowtowing to the children's whims against, you know, is working against the students. The first year that I taught homeschool, 100% of my students were on camera. The last time I taught homeschool, I was lucky if I got two students on camera, and the parents said, she's shy, don't push it. And I'm like, how can I recognize, like, it's already bad enough that we're separated with a screen. I see that doing the students a massive disservice, but now you want their face offline so I can't see if they're paying attention or tracking. I didn't feel like I was in integrity, and that's why I removed myself from teaching live, because I felt like I can't tell if I'm teaching your students if they're absorbing anything. So it's interesting seeing these parents giving their students so much leeway when I agree with you. I feel like students need authority and leadership.
Yeah, it's such a tough row to hoe too. And maybe definitely on that point, I think to myself, I came out from like the opposite, which I think a lot of us do. We came through the system and we found it to be stifling. And it's funny now, it's like, be careful what you wish for, that sort of thing.
Right.
So now we've created this, you know, this very free and open learning thing and co-ops and pods and, you know, all the parents are going to get together. And it's very democratic in all that means, good and bad. And now we're having, as evidenced on some of these online forums, we're having the exact opposite problem, where the children turned adults are complaining they didn't have this discipline and they didn't have, you know, the skills that they believe they need and so forth. But I don't think it has to be one or the other. I mean, it's like that baby analogy you used. And that's what I'm trying to do in my own little way here in Connecticut, is to, you know, keep what I think is the best of the classroom and that discipline and that type of environment, just like the actor on the stage. That's an environment. The theater is an environment, and it's a space, so to speak. We ought to reclaim that idea of the classroom as a space where a certain activity can take place in the most productive manner, just like a greenhouse for growing plants. And to really approach the classroom as if it were an artist studio or whatever, but you need certain things in place. You need a certain discipline, art, writing as well, the plastic arts or writing, right? You need discipline to harness that. I tell that to the children and I try to remember it myself. You could have the best horse in the world, but if you don't discipline that horse, it just runs around on the plains. It's only with the discipline of the racetrack and the confines of the racetrack, or the river is another one, right? A river, uncontrolled, as I'm afraid we found out this past couple of weeks, a river, water uncontrolled is chaos, is true chaos. We watch some of the old religions and the myths, everything was just water, right? There's the symbolism of chaos, right? But if you can control that river, you can have a dam, so to speak. You can irrigate Arizona, New Mexico, whatever. It's with that discipline, with that constriction, in fact, that you can produce things of value. And the same goes with education too, that some of these boundaries wouldn't do anybody any harm.
Yeah, agreed. And I feel like I see a lot of parents who they just, whatever the child wants to do, that's where they go, and nothing is being imposed. And I wonder, and I'm curious, you know, how this lines up with your vision of what will happen to academia as we're watching Rome fall. You know, I'm prone to saying this is my first global apocalypse. I'm figuring it out as I go along, you know, and it's like,
I like that.
Will everything be wiped out? Because I see a lot of parents who are unschooling, homeschooling, assuming that like, everything's going to be wiped out. So their, you know, their kid is going to learn a skill like being an electrician or something, so they'll have a job. But then I also see like, okay, well, your child may not want to be a writer, but there's certainly value in our current culture of knowing how to string together a sentence, understanding proper etiquette and grammar, like
etiquette. How, yes.
Do you know what I'm saying? So part of it is like, we're hedging our bets as far as like how much is going to be wiped out, what the future is going to look like. So is what you're doing at the Institute setting people up for our current structure? Is it setting it up for post-apocalyptic? Do you know what I'm saying? It's like, it's also bizarre.
Yes, I get what you're saying for sure there. And I think... Well, I mean, as I alluded to before, I suppose in this language, post-apocalyptic, but post-apocalyptic with, you know, with a certain, I hope, maturity. And I think as with your own work, too, you've come across sorts that there's a lack of oftentimes, you know, people might be able to envision what an economic system no longer existing or an educational system no longer existing as we know it. But the discipline to weather that storm and to be on the other side. I see that with lots of good work in the alt community and things like that. There's a real disconnect between the situation now and what might happen, maybe what should happen, whatever.
Right.
And how do we make that? How do we execute that? And I hope what we're doing here in Connecticut is to, yes, prepare for that. I don't see... like I say, I see formal education basically as having served its purpose for the ruling class. Mm-hmm. I see schools largely having served the purpose and being in relationship to the state and the larger power structure, which is beyond just the civil structure. I see the relationship of schools to that very much like how national churches were in the 19th century. Mm-hmm. They were... used and abused by the civil structures after the Reformation. You had all these national churches. What were you able to do with all that? You were able to funnel, you know, loyalty towards the state. And then finally, by the 19th century, the state was done with that. The churches had served their purpose, and now they can all go off and be charities. And there was a severance in Connecticut and all in New England, and we had established churches at that time, Congregationalist here. And, you know, they were kind of let go to seed, and the state moved on in its commercial drumbeat. And then schools came, and schools basically hoard themselves out just like churches did in the previous generations. And they, you know, completely sold what it meant to be scholars and the life of the mind and whatever the state and not just the state, but the whole economical apparatus, Rockefeller and all that, whatever they wanted, the schools, you know, kowtowed to that. And to the point now, without blushing, without any shame at all, most schoolmen and most people attending schools and parents and things will nakedly admit that schools are for a job. Education is for a job. Right. And speaking of this post-apocalyptic thing, you know, if you read enough history, you realize often there are times where kind of problems solve themselves. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is such a problem. In America, we have a foot in at least in two, if not three different worlds when it comes to why are we educating? So in America, we don't have a single cult or a single religion like many nations have. So the school process fills a cultic or ritualistic need. It's the one thing all Americans have gone through, more or less, right? We've all read The Outsiders and Romeo and Juliet, and we've all been to detention. It's the ritual. You have to see it as almost a religious ritual. And the reason it has such a prominence in America is because we have no other unifying ritual, because mm-hmm. we're such a diverse country.
Yep.
So you want to say something?
Oh, no. Please continue. I was agreeing.
Yes. The second foot, so to speak, that we have is kind of this old classical thing, which I've desperately tried to revive. I don't know how well it's taken, but this idea of the life of the mind, that Western culture is your inheritance. This is your property, just like your old grandfather's Cadillac he wills you is your property when he kicks the can, right? Don Quixote is your property. Cervantes and Dante and Shakespeare, that's your inheritance in this culture. Mm-hmm. Right? That's that old classical thing. So we still have dribs and drabs of that floating around in terms of educational motivation, or at least educational sloganing. And then we have the real gorilla in the room, which people maybe at one point were hesitant to say, but they're pretty honest about it now, right? We go to school for a job. President Obama used to say that with Common Core, right? The students are going to be shovel ready of all the jobs, shovel ready on day one. Job ready on day one, you know, day after graduation, you're going to hit the ground and start making money, start being a tax cow for Uncle Sam. There's going to be ready to roll, Danny.
Right.
And that leads to the schizophrenia of American education. And maybe some of the erratic nature we see in people that we come across in terms of why we're doing what we're doing, and then where we're going, and how are we actually executing that day to day? Why is it so erratic? Well, I think it goes back to that erratic motivation and that concentration, our own personal stuff that was busted for all those years. These telephones don't help things either. And then indeed the uncertainty of what's coming. So yeah, we're planning post-apocalyptically, but we're also trying to keep that discipline to plow through this. I mean, during COVID, this is my last point to your question, during COVID, you know, all of a sudden I went from being John the Baptist for, you know, 5 years before COVID-19. And I was the crazy one. And we need to do with colleges what we've done with homeschool somewhat, and, you know, kind of break off the academy reservation and start our own schools. And all of a sudden COVID came in, like all these schools were popping up, all these online works and things. And then they all went away. You know, there was an enthusiasm for those 3 years we were grounded. And then people went on with things, and all these good works, which were growing, they were growing up, then they all withered away.
Which speaks to the point you were making as we started our conversation of the kind of ephemeral, impermanent nature of things pop up and we forget. And, you know, it's like what just happened in, like, we don't even remember what happened in Maui. Everyone just like moved on. When, you know, I had thought like, well, this is going to shut it all down because Maui's not going to have it. But it's like this training, like, oh, we have these ideas for these great new schools. And it's like, oh, no more mask mandates. We don't need them anymore.
Right. Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
And it's and that problem that I mentioned, like this divided mind and kind of murky thing. You know, if the mechanization of labor is what it's hinted at being, and I've seen some interesting things in that regard, confirming that, in a sense, that problem that we as pedagogues have about this divided mind, it's going to solve itself, meaning that the only people that are going to actually at all be in schools are those who are there only for that idea of mastering the heritage of the West, mastering mathematics as a discipline worthy of itself and the other sciences too, because literally it going to school for a job will be obsolete because the whole economy as we understood it, which is predicated on all this, will no longer exist. And so this problem in a strange way, maybe in a painful way, may solve itself yet.
But it also, I think speaks to one of like the biggest fictions propping up our culture is that we're here to work, right?
Yes.
Versus exploring topics to learn about life, ontology, existence, to understand the interconnectedness, you know, separating math from music, from sacred geometry, from science, keeping everything so fragmented and thus making life here so meaningless if it's not about making the buck, versus like the beauty of an intellectual life, the beauty of diving deep into subjects, learning from them, making connections, you know, discovering novelty, which all comes from training the mind in a certain way that seems to be, you know, being pushed to the side and not recognized as a value in and of itself.
Yes, absolutely. Hear, hear on that point for certain. And we don't have to imagine this thing. By the way, I to what you just said, I love your little Mandela behind you about speaking of connectedness.
Thank you.
But yes, we don't have to just imagine what this idea of unified knowledge and a culture where things have a value in se is. To do that, we need to simply look back at the medieval world. The medieval world, that would be one of the, I would say, when I teach it, you know, one of the three or four main points of what defines and differentiates the medieval mindset from the modern. It's this idea of all the sciences having a unity, and the idea of working for its own sake, not for a check. And that would be most perfectly realized, of course, in the monasteries. Now, right. We don't necessarily need to adhere to the Christian religion to appreciate these points, but as simply as a culture artifact, we're not having just to grope in the dark for what this might look like. And that was one of the, I mean, that would be, I would think, one of the greatest errors of modern economics is this idea that one works for pay. Right. And so therefore the object, the pen, the beautiful Apocrypha Stacey's pen, the pen doesn't, I make the pen not to write as I would as an ancient or medieval. I make the pen to sell it in order that I may get something in the future. And we call this capitalism, but that's a really loaded term, because I would say the same errors are often present in responses to capitalism as well. It's the problem of the whole, I guess, future preference with an object, and therefore the devaluing of labor that comes with that. And that, if anything like this mechanization is in the offing, and this digitalization is the offing, if anything like what people are indicating is coming, that's going to cause a tremendous amount of soul searching in the West. And I think these devils that think they run this system, that's the only reason they've actually kept this economic system around as long as it has. Because they realize when they roll that out, you're going to have such a crisis of meaning. People who've been brought up innocently, having their innocence abused and being told that to labor is to make money and to have a job. And that's not going to be there anymore. And you thought you had a problem with people like Willie Loman in Death of a Salesman, you know, coming to retirement and not having anything to do and putting the potato in the car exhaust. Wait for when this comes. And that's, I think, even these devils are balking at what will happen because of this fundamental enlightenment error that you labor to get something in the future, and that the thing itself and the laborer himself is only consequential to the object.
Yeah, it's as you're speaking, I'm thinking of the Bhagavad Gita, right? Where Arjuna's telling Krishna, like, we don't work for the fruits of our labor, we work to work. You know, we do the work because, and it's about purpose, right? And we saw what happened during, you know, what I call COVID, of these people who had no purpose, and then all of a sudden their purpose was to be a tattletale, to be rude to the person not wearing a mask, right? I see all of these things as a result of not having purpose. So it's exactly that. I don't even want to say training people, but encouraging people to do a good job because it feels good to do a good job. It just feels good to do something to the best of our ability and to find those things that give us joy and do them for the sake of doing them and also being part of the collective, being part of a greater whole, which also seems, you know, to be being chipped away at pretty hardcore right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and as we prepare for this, you know, some accounting of philosophy or faith might be in order, and I don't know what that is in such a diverse society, but I think that, you know, coming up with some systematic group of virtues that people can rally around, something that has value in, say, honesty, whatever that is, as a society, we need to really. It's amazing. I mean, as we what do they say? 15,000 hours were in school. That's a number I hear always put out there. You know, 15,000 hours in school. That seems to be right. And yet we have people, a total novelty in human existence. People who reach adulthood and they have no metaphysical understanding of themselves, their society, anything, that entire aspect of human existence, which obsessed all of our cultural grandfathers and still obsesses most of the world in these super educated Western societies, this entire aspect has been let go to atrophy. And I think this is a tremendous invitation that history gives us at this hour to reclaim that, to reclaim philosophy, in order to provide against this meaninglessness. You don't want to be a Karen or a Kevin in the next COVID 2.0 with a mask or whatever silliness they'll tell us. You know, maybe we'll have to wear Q-tips in our ears. I don't know.
Right.
What the anything to keep that red spiky cartoon away from me. Anything, Danny.
Yes, exactly. Well, it seems like that was really part of the plan. Like this atheism, this like the removal of any sort of unifying cosmology is what has people reaching outside of themselves for validation, for permission, you know, because if we were self-source with a true connection to capital L life, this stuff wouldn't work. I'm curious, and I want to go deeper into the Institute itself, but I know you mentioned classical learning and Shakespeare, and I'm a big fan of Robert Frederick's podcast, The Hidden Life is Best. Have you heard about it?
No, but I will now. Let me get that down. Go on.
It's definitely one of my favorites. And in the podcast, he proposes that Francis Bacon was responsible for the Shakespeare Project, and that this Shakespeare Project was the insertion of, scientism, of scientific materialism, was really like this great grand co-opting of culture. And what he says in it is like, why is Shakespeare required in every liberal arts education? Why can you not get through the established school system without being indoctrinated into the whole Shakespeare Project? What's your take on it? That does it for the first half of my conversation with John Coleman. As you are inspired to tune into the second half of our conversation, you can find that over on both my Patreon and Locals communities. Those addresses are dannykatz.locals.com and patreon.com/dannykatz. At both communities, for as little as $5 a month, you get access to all of my second half conversations, plus oodles of bonus content, plus the ever gratifying knowledge that you are supporting a content creator in keeping on. Also reminding you to sign up for my newsletter at dannykatz.com, and once again reminding you that I am offering the world's only pop propaganda media literacy course for teens as well as for grownups. But the course was initially created for teens who are being homeschooled, for homeschool teens, I guess that's the same thing, ages 14 and up. The 11 module course features a large scale overview of the media landscape. It explains how culture is reliant upon propaganda and media manipulation. And it helps us recognize all of the tools, techniques that the propagandists use to attempt to manipulate us. Once we clue in to how their shenanigans are working, they no longer work on us. So we get to expand our critical thinking, safeguard our agency, our confidence, our self-esteem, while rendering us impervious to Media Manipulation and Propaganda. You can find that course at my website, dannykatz.com, or you can head straight to poppropaganda.com, where your registration gets you instant lifetime access. That does it. Thank you so much for sharing your sacred attention with me. Thank you for remembering that every word matters, that you are omniscopic amazingness. I will see you over on the Patreon and the locals. Have a rockin' day.